Well, if you are here for the first time, I am going to help you out, and I am going to give us a brief overview of the setting of Daniel. If you are someone who is going to continue to be here and hear more of Daniel, I really, really encourage you, if you weren't here last week, to head to our website and to listen, because last week, this is kind of, in a sense, part B, but last week we really did just a big overview of where Daniel fits in the story and the history of the Bible. We learned about the exile of the Jews to Babylon and why that happened, how that was prophesied and predicted. And so, again, I'm going to give us just the short, like, 2-minute overview so we understand where we are for today. But if you are going to be here ongoing, are going to hear pieces of Daniel, I would, again, just really encourage you to go and to listen to that and to let that be a background of what's going on in the story. But here's our quick overview anyways for today. So in the 6th century or so BC, we have the northern kingdom of Israel already taken over by the Assyrians, and in rolls the Babylonian Empire. And they take over the Assyrians, and then they come down and they take over the southern kingdom of Judah. We know that some of the principal characters in this are King Nebuchadnezzar, who we're going to hear about today. And we know in Kings, we can read about the kings of Israel during that time. And that's kind of what I would suggest you go back to last week and catch up on all of that history for. But for today, it's just important to know that this is what we're going to catch on here. This is the first time that Nebuchadnezzar comes all the way to Jerusalem. But this isn't the time that he destroys it. He comes back later when we're already in the middle of what's happening in Daniel and actually destroys the city. During this time, he's just there to basically conquer it, but he lets it stay. And we're going to get into the first couple of verses here to get some of our background. So let me just read the first 3 to 4 verses or so. It says, "In the 3rd year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hands with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God." So that's kind of where we're at. This is the 3rd year of the reign of King Jehoiakim. That's one of the Jewish kings that we can read about in Kings or in Chronicles. And it's in the 3rd year of his reign that Nebuchadnezzar comes down and he besieges the land. And he takes, we don't read it here, but he takes about 3,000 or so people from the land of Israel to bring back to Babylon. And he doesn't just say, the first 3,000 right here. He takes 3,000 of the young generation, the best and the brightest that are coming up. We're going to hear about some 4 names that we're pretty familiar with if we've spent a little bit of time in the Bible. And they're probably a 14, 15 or so at the time they're being taken. Here's the ones who have been in the priestly courts learning from the next generation of the priests. Here's the ones who have been with the skilled artisans learning how to be the next ones to make golden and silver treasures to put in the house of God. Here are the builders and the scribes, the people who are actually more than just kind of your average farmer out in the field, more than just your average house servant. These are the people who can not just be valuable prisoners of war to take back to Babylon. Hey, Jerusalem, don't act up. We've got your kids in our house. I mean, that's certainly a part of it. And it's not just like what the Assyrians did, where they wanted to just take some of your people out, bring in some other people, so that way you just wouldn't exist anymore. They wanted to wipe you out, Babylon. They wanted you to want to become one of them. They wanted you to willfully choose to become one of them, to lean into their ways, to bring up your youth in their ways, that your youth would choose the ways of Babylon, that they might come by around later and say, yeah, no, this is it. This is what you guys got to check out. If we can raise up these generations, we can send them back. We can put them into power. They can be our stewards there. And then the people in Jerusalem or wherever else we conquer, but here, for us, Jerusalem, those people can become more like us. That was the hope. Not just to erase them from history and rewrite it with your own, but to bring them in like a melting pot. I mean, in a sense, almost like what we kind of experience here in our country. It's not just like, hey, come here, and this is the exact way of life that we've lived for thousands of years. It's almost more like, hey, being an American is being the blend of all of our cultures that have come here and in our own unique way. And so that's kind of what we can think about with Babylon. It becomes even more so once Persia takes over. But that's for a little bit later on in our book. For right now, just think about the 3,000 or so that are taken back in this first wave. That they're the youngest, the best, the brightest, the hope and the future of Israel. And so this is who's headed back. And it's not just the people, it's also the things of the house of the temple. God's treasures. The gold and the silver where you would fill up with oils that would anoint, that would hold the candles or the incense. The decorations that were ordered by God to be there. I mean, for us, a parallel, imagine someone coming in and taking our baptistry, ripping the cross off the wall, and then marching us with our things thousands of miles to another place, and taking our things and putting it in the house of worship of your God and keeping us there, that we might every day have to walk down the streets and see the temple where our things are. Our God, who told us that he would defend us, he would defend his house. And his things have been taken and put up in this temple. There's this, and it just continues over the time of Nebuchadnezzar to grow. We're going to hear about his pride and the building plans, and we can see that in history. Take a note. I would encourage you later, go look up the Ishtar Gate. Go look up the Procession of Babylon, the recreations that we have in museums today. They are brilliant, gorgeous pieces of architecture that speak to the pride of Nebuchadnezzar, and they lead into the temple. Here comes Daniel walking past this ornate wall that speaks to the loss of his home and his people, and that things that are inside of that gate in the temple of Marduk, those are our God's things. It's heartbreaking and it's crushing, and this is the situation that they're in. Like we mentioned last week, this is the perfect opportunity for the Jewish people and the Jewish culture and the religion of the true God to just be gone. I mean, there are more cultures and countries and beliefs and ways of life that have come and gone and we don't even know about anymore than we could count. Countless times where maybe we get a little glimpse of a name of some tribe that a culture we do know about conquered, but they're gone. And the Jewish people, they're conquered. And what happens in kind of in the middle of Daniel, we don't necessarily in Daniel get it. Once again, listen last week, you'll find out where that plugs in. When Jerusalem is fully wiped out, I mean, the temple is destroyed. It's all over. It's not just that our treasures are in Babylon. It's that our house of worship is fully gone. The Jewish people and their way of life could have been over right here, right now, and that was it. But it's not what happened. They strengthen their resolve. They lean into his ways. They lean into what they know. And that's what our story today is going to be about, is we see this first moment, this first entry into Babylon, and we see the way that Daniel and his friends resist becoming the Babylonians. They stay true to who they are, and this is going to continue over their whole time there. So we've read verses 1 through 3, one through 2, let's pick back up in 3. It says in verse 3, "Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace, and to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. The king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate, and of the wine that he drank. They were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time, they were to stand before the king." All right, we'll hold again there. So that's what we talked about, that, hey, we're not taking just the ruffians. We didn't just gather up some people and brought them on the way. We got your best. And they came back with us. But then it's interesting. They're not just treated like prisoners. Like we said, we're not just bringing you back and holding you here just so that your family back home doesn't act up. And we're not even just bringing here just to teach you, but, you know, like, you got to get through school. It ain't going to be fun. No, that they're prisoners who are going to be eating from the king's table. I mean, imagine that. Like, we've all in some time looked back and we've watched a TV show or a movie, maybe read a book about some ancient period with kings or with rulers that were absolute. And we know what it meant to eat at the king's table. He had the best food. He had the most food. It was richly prepared. In this time, in the time of the pagans, his food is first offered to the gods. And since they're false idols and they don't take the food, then it comes next to the king. The food that was fit for the gods comes to the king, and that's the food he's willing to pass off to the ones who are taken. Now, of course, the king's not starving himself. Nebuchadnezzar's eating. But what he is doing is, like we said, he's drawing them in. What's better? What's sweeter, honey or vinegar? Here's the honey. Yeah, eat from my table. Drink of my wine. Be like that. Be in a stupor all day. It was a lot easier for them to drink wine throughout the day because by drinking wine, you were drinking something that had gone through the fermentation process and it had killed all the bacteria, and you knew that you were way less likely to get sick. So you just sip on wine throughout the day. Have that buzz. Be loose of mind. That's what they're being offered. To be rich and fat like kings and to be trained in the ways of the Babylonians. Some of you are going to get to come before the king and be lifted into high places of power. After your years of schooling, once you're ready, once you're 17, 18 years old, we're bringing you into the palace. And now it's Babylon's Got Talent. And we're going to see which of you are ready to be up here. Who's got something for me? So that's what's going on. Let's pick back up in 6. Carry on with our story here. We're about to meet our characters. Among these were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. And the chief eunuchs gave them this name. Here's the names that we might be a little bit more familiar with, at least for his friends. Daniel, he called Belshazzar. Hananiah, he called Shadrach. Mishael, he called Meshach. And Azariah, he called Abednego. So these four men, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, they're Jews of the tribe of Judah. And they're taken. And again, in this continuation of, we're going to make you a little bit more Babylonian. And for these men where their name matters, like when just a couple months ago when we were looking through Ruth and how their names mattered and they said something, these fellows too. The Hebrew name said something, and so often they say something about who they believe God is or what he's doing, what he might have already done in a family's life perhaps. And then here they get here, and the chief officer of the court, he gives them Babylonian names. And this is what you're known by now. This is your identity. Your identity is no longer of the tribe of Judah. Your identity is now Babylonian. But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Therefore, he asked the chiefs of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. And God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief eunuchs. Now, here's the first thing that I want to step back from and draw just outside of the narrative and take a point here. We're going to see this throughout the story. And we see this throughout the Bible, and I try as often as I can to point this out when it comes, because it matters. It says, and God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief eunuchs. God moved in the way that he had planned. Daniel didn't show up there by accident, and God said, whoopsie daisy, we'll see what can work. He didn't just hope that the chief eunuch was going to have compassion, and if he didn't, then, well, maybe the next guy will. God gave him compassion. These gentlemen are in a situation, and yet God has placed them there, and they know it. We looked at Psalms that spoke about how they were crying out, God, you have abandoned us. We don't know why, but you've got some reason, and so make it known. And that's the heart of all of them that are gone in exile right now. We don't know what's going on. But we know that you've got something, and God does have something. He is moving in this moment. We're going to see him move throughout Daniel, and it's not by accident. It's by his plan. He has got something going on. And so throughout Daniel, I want us to hold on to that. Their exile for 70 years, objectively not a good thing. That's not fun. If you had asked Daniel, hey, Daniel, just born Daniel, draw up your life. How do you want your 90 years of life to go? I would imagine it wouldn't include the destruction of his temple and exile to a foreign land. He probably would have wrote it up differently. In fact, if you had said, oh, well, your perfect vision of that, Daniel, is really nice. Instead, I've got a different plan. How about you get 70 years of exile and the temple's destroyed? You never get to go home again. You're going to die in Babylon. How does that sound? He probably would have said, not great. All of them, all 15,000 people that get yanked out over the course of 30-some years, that get yanked out of Jerusalem and taken to Babylon, I'm sure none of them were super thrilled. I'm sure all of them would have liked something different to happen. How often can we see in our life situations that objectively just aren't great? We're not thrilled about. This isn't how we would have written it up. But God had to have them here for 70 years because he's got something bigger going on. Daniel had to interpret dreams for Nebuchadnezzar. He had to display great faith in the courts of Cyrus. He had to give us prophecy for future times that already did pass and future times that are still to come. All of that to be recorded in scripture that was written 3,000 years ago almost. Pushing it. 2,700. And we have it here today still to have faith. So these gentlemen, they walked in the valley of death that we see in Psalm 23. And yet they were not alone. God was with them. God gave the eunuch the compassion to move in that way. He didn't have it before, but God gave it to him. So when we see this in Daniel, and we see these moments that are going to come up, stories that we're familiar with, like the lion's den, like the furnace, I'm sure none of these guys, that's their objective best way to live. They wouldn't have written it up that way. Yet God had a plan for ultimate good, and we've got to trust that. If we're going to trust him, we've got to trust that. The ultimate plan is for ultimate good. I might be in an objectively bad situation, but one, again, it's for the ultimate good. And I believe that he is the ultimate good, and so I will trust in whatever he's got. And two, to see that he's in control and he's with me in this. Not only is what he the ultimate good and he's got that planned, but I'm not having to walk in this alone. He's going to be there with me and he's going to move, especially as I trust that more and more and I move in that faith more and more. The stronger we lean into that, the stronger that he can hold us up. A trust fall is not much of a trust fall if I just slowly creep myself back and let you take my weight slowly. But the trust and the strength that you gain when you actually fall back and just let the person catch you is enormous because that person is actually catching you. So when we actually let the Lord catch us and hold us and support us, and we're not saying I trust you while standing on two legs and holding it down over here, we're actually leaning into what he has for us, and he's not having to spend time, pull us off our own feet to say, no, you don't trust me. Please do, though. So let's continue on in Daniel. Daniel said, hey, give me 10 days. For 10 days, I'm not eating from the table. And for 10 days, I'm not going to drink the wine. Here's what the chief of the eunuch says. He says, I fear the Lord, the king, who assigned your food and your drink. For why should he see that you were in worse condition than the youths who are of your own age? So you would endanger my head with the king? In other words, Ashpenaz's whole point is like, hey man, what did I do here? Please, if you get sick, it's my head, not yours. I got told to feed you from the king's table, so I'm just following orders here. Please. Here's what Daniel has to say to that. Then Daniel said to the steward whom the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat from the king's food be observed by you, and deal with your servants according to what you see. So 10 days. How much can go wrong in 10 days? Hey, you'll notice if we're weaning out, you'll notice you can get us on the king's diet. But for 10 days, test us and see how this goes. Only vegetables, only water. We're going to trust that that water's not going to get us sick. And we're going to trust that we're going to live into just the vegetables. We're going to get, I mean, we know that the Jewish people have strict food laws, but we're going to go stricter than that. We're going down to just vegetables. And you're going to see that we'll still be strong. You're going to see that we'll still be strong. So that's what happens. We'll pick back up. Verse 14. So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. At the end of 10 days, it was seen that they were in better appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took away their food and the wine that they were to drink and gave them vegetables. So what happens after 10 days? Daniel's right. They're in better shape. They're feeling better. They're looking better. They're more useful than all of the other youths who are eating all the rich food from the table, who are drinking the wine. And what's the reaction? All right, well, I guess you're off the king's diet then. Time to get on the vegetables and water diet with the rest of them. All of God's people come together in unity. They live together in one way again. And that way is not in the way of the Babylonians. Only time we're going to hop out of Daniel today. Let me read for you 1 Corinthians 10:31. I don't even need a flip. I know it. But so whether you eat or drink, whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God. In this section that Paul is writing there in 1 Corinthians, whether you eat or drink, whether you eat or drink, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God. Even this little thing, eating and drinking. We're prisoners who just got marched from Judah to Babylon. Yeah, I'm going to eat some of the king's cow and I'm going to drink some of his wine because I'm hungry and tired. It would be an easy stance to take. We're not even really breaking our food laws. I mean, just don't give us pork and shellfish. Make sure we keep things pretty kosher. We're going to be good. I mean, they could have lived still kind of from the king's table and lived under their laws. But no, that's not what they do. That's not what Daniel does. He says, this food that's been offered to a god, not for me. He says, your ways and your wine and your table, not for me. I'm going to use this little moment of food and water to still bring glory to my God, to still bring honor to my God, to prove who he is and what he can do, that we can live in our ways and still be strong. We can live in our ways together and still be strong. In these verses, it's short, but we can see the resistance that they put up. I mean, think about it. They're prisoners. They might not be in iron bar cells, but they're prisoners, thousands of miles from home, young, 14, 15 years old. And these guys, they don't fold. And that's really the main, if we're going to draw anything out just for today, just from this, it's that as Christians, we might not actually be physically have taken from our homes and taken to another land on earth to be in exile. But if we are a believer, we're called aliens in this world. We're called as separate in this world. We might have been here for the first time. We might not have been brought here on exile. But once we are saved by the Lord, once we're a new life, home is elsewhere. And this is temporary. And while we're here, we've got two choices. Do I hold this belief that the Bible is true and God is who he says he is? But also I'm going to compromise and I'm going to live in the culture that I'm in. Because, I mean, it's easy. And sure, like I'm not even going to go all the way. I won't go all the way to sin. I'm just going to do what's in the middle. I'm going to be in the middle. I'm not going to go all the way over here. I'm not going to steal and rob. I mean, that would be wrong. I'm not going to turn into a murderer. I'm not going to be unfaithful to my partner. But it's just music. Who cares what words are really into it? You know, I mean, We're just going to go on a vacation together. I mean, I know what my friends are going to go do tonight, but we just won't go with them all the time. We'll just go out one night with them, just to be good guests. How quick we are to say, yeah, you are God and you are who you are. And I'm going to give everything to you. You purchased me on the cross. In that moment on the cross, in the moment that you indwelt in me with your spirit, I am bought by yours. You are my Lord and my King and my Savior. And I'm just not going to really do what you want. I'm going to just be the wild old servant, I guess. Why? Why not be like Daniel? Why not be like his friends? Why not sit there as a 15-year-old in the face of the chief servant of the king and say, no thanks. No, I'm going to trust my God, and I'm going to trust the way that he has. Because if he's the ultimate good, and if he's everything that I can trust in, if he's given me everything that I have now in my life now, if all good that I have, if I believe he's the source of it, then I'm just going to continue to live in his ways. Because his way is good, and whatever might be comfortable is comfortable, but it's not good. Whatever might be easy is easy, but it's not always good. And so I'm going to choose good. I'm going to choose the Lord and his ways. And I'm going to choose to not compromise. And I'm going to choose to lean into the people that I have around me who are trying to do the same thing because we're in the same spot. Daniel didn't have to go and stand there alone and say no. He stood there with three of his friends too, together. Only them. Thousands of their brethren are happy to eat from the king's table. But the four of them, they were willing to not compromise. And what happens? It brings all the rest of them together. And they all are back grouped together, living together. It's a testament for what we can do. We can read this and recognize, hey, I might not be the prophet Daniel. God might not be calling me one day to sit in a lion's den and not be eaten by lions. But he also might be calling me to live in my town and to do something that's uncomfortable, to not go with the culture of my city and my neighbors. He might be calling me to go somewhere and to preach the gospel, and he might be asking me to do something that isn't the easiest thing to do. There's a lot of things that he could be calling us to in our life that might not be as grand as surviving in the furnace with Christ. But there's plenty of things in our life that he'd be calling us to do that bring the ultimate good. And it's up to us to continue to stay faithful and not to compromise with the culture, to not ride the fence, to not become a compound, but to just be his, fully bought. That's all he asks from us. Just give me all of who you are. Die to yourself, be born again in me, and I've got the rest. Just live in this life. If we do believe who he says he is, if that's what we're doing as Christians and we're saying yes to that, I want this, then we ought to choose that. We ought to not say, well, this seems like a good thing and I want the benefits of this and I'm pretty generally on board, but I don't know about really living all the way in this. I mean, there's some tough parts in this. Let's believe that he is who he says he is, that he is the God that created everything out of nothing, that he is the God who spoke in the Bible and then did in the Bible to prove he is who he says he is, that he is the God who himself showed up as man, lived, died, and was resurrected and said, I have offered repentance to you because I've paid the price. That God is the one who we can trust in. And if we lean into him, we don't hold back, we don't say we're going to compromise, then that kind of faith, that kind of unity that we have in the body of people who are locked arms doing that together, that's what Daniel has. So I hope for us that as we go through the rest of Daniel, as we go through our lives and through Scripture, we can see two things. That he is calling us not to compromise, and he's going to be the one to give us the strength to do it. Us on our own, we don't win that fight. We can resist, but ultimately it's like swimming in a nasty current. It will pull you out at some point. You will tire out, and you cannot fight alone. He will pull you in. He will keep you up. He will be the one there. Again, Daniel didn't have to stand and just hope that the eunuch wouldn't have compassion on his request. He just said his request with faith, knowing that God would bring the compassion that was needed there. Let's finish our chapter here for today, and we'll kind of conclude. As for these four youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom. And Daniel had understandings in all visions and dreams. At the end of the time when the king had commanded that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king spoke with them. And among all of them, none were found that were like Daniel and Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah. Therefore, they stood before the king. And in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in his kingdom. And Daniel was there until the first year of King Cyrus. So what happens by the result of these gentlemen not compromising? The Lord lifts them up. They trust in the direction the Lord's taking them, and the Lord builds them up for where he's taking them. Fellas, I've got plans for you. And for you to have an ear of the king, I need you to be the one in the king's ear. So I'm going to give you such skill and wisdom that you might become part of the court of the king, that he would listen to you because you are 10 times better than anyone else he's got. It says Daniel that what he has is he's able to interpret dreams and visions. And so our next chapter is just that. He interprets the dream of Nebuchadnezzar where no one else could. For today, though, as we close up today, as we close up chapter one and we begin our story of these gentlemen as they first come into Babylon, into captivity, these 3 years as they grow up and they get put into the court of the kings, it ends with there. And Daniel was there until the first year of King Cyrus. He's there for the whole time. He's there longer than two, but it means to say that he's there fully all the way through Nebuchadnezzar, all the way through those who come after him too, all the way until Cyrus takes him. And then he's there even into Cyrus. He doesn't go. He doesn't leave. This wasn't just a little moment. God lifted him up. He didn't lift him up just because he had faith. But because he had faith, he was able to walk into the plans where God had him. But we shouldn't read this and assume it's just, well, if I just hope hard enough for anything, then it'll happen. What we ought to read is if we trust God enough, trust in his ways enough, live our life according to how he has for us, that he will care for us and bring the right things into our way, the things that he has for us. I can't just have great faith that I can go find a mountain lion den out there and live. I can have great faith that if I live my life according to the word of God and the way that I know that he's planned life for us to be, that if I do that faithfully, he's going to be with me along the way and he's going to lead me where he's got me. I didn't plan to come to Utah 6 months before I came here, but he brought me here. And I didn't plan to come to Panguitch a month before he brought me here, but he brought me here. And each step of the way in my life, the whole way, I can see it even before coming here. From leaving college, going to the first church that I worked at, each step of the way is obvious when the Lord is knocking on a door and he's bringing you to the next place. All you have to do is just keep faithfully putting one foot in front of the other. Live according to his ways. Don't compromise with the world. And trust that when he's got something to come, he'll bring it. He'll bring it in time. That his way is the ultimate good. And that's all we're saying. God, I believe your word. I believe you are the ultimate good. I've given myself as a servant to you because of that. And so I'm just going to trust that the rest of the way. I'm going to trust you are the ultimate good and I don't have to compromise. Let us pray.